I've spent about 11 years of my life in Korea, starting in the mid-70s when I went as a Peace Corps volunteer and spent 2 years there. And from that, joined the U.S. Foreign Service, the U.S. Diplomatic Service. Went back again in the 80s at a time of huge political turmoil and change in Korea. And then circled back around, as life sometimes does, and was ambassador there from 2008 to 2011. So I had the great privilege of being, I think, not only a witness to some extraordinary history, but also a kind of a participant in some small ways as in Korea's own journey of economic and political development.
You speak fluent Korean.
Well, I studied Korean in the 1970s as a Peace Corps volunteer and as the only non-Korean living in the small town where I lived then. I certainly use a lot of Korean. I studied more in the Foreign Service and dusted it off 20 years later before I went back as ambassador. I think it was good for my aging brain. And I think that, more than anything, helped me understand all the changes that Korea has experienced over the years and also the continuity of the culture and the history. So
it's almost impossible, isn't it, to truly know a culture unless you know the language. It's such an insight into the culture.
I agree with that. I think that the process of studying the language itself is a process of learning that culture, because they are, as you suggest, so embedded in each other. So even if you don't get to the point of, you know, being able to do a full interview in that language or give a speech in that language or do certain things, I really think that without the effort to learn the language, you can't begin to penetrate a little bit of what that country is about.
Mm-hmm. How frustrating is it for you, as someone who knows this country so well, Korea, to live in a country that knows so little about it?
Well, I mean, I would say this. I mean, as a Foreign Service officer, I've spent most of my career overseas working in other countries and representing the United States. And, you know, at various times coming back, it was always a little hard to, as anyone who travels knows, to come back from, well, the Balkans at a time of great turmoil, or Northern Ireland, where people maybe fall a little bit more and find that people, yeah, have their own lives. They're busy. We're a big continental country. So the level of interest in these things varies a great deal. In terms of Korea, I guess I would say I've noted over the years, since my perspective now is several decades, that generally speaking, Americans know a lot more about Korea than they did some years ago. Now, some years ago, it might have been the Korean War, or maybe of a certain generation, they might remember a TV show called MASH or something like that. But now, you know, I think with the Korean-American community, its success throughout the United States in business, in academia, in all walks of life, South Korea's own success as an economic power, as a source of culture like Psy and the famous Song of the Summer, or was it the spring? I've forgotten. So I think, comparatively speaking, when you say Korea to Americans today, you get a more varied response and a little more interest, actually, than some years ago.
I want to talk a bit about North Korea. There were many, I think many in the diplomatic community too, who had high hopes that Kim Jong-un would be more friendly with the West, that he would be different than his father. And that's not been the case. Were you surprised as well? Did you have that expectation? Or just,
I guess after all these years, I mean, in my own career of mostly, you know, hard and disappointing experience and trying to find a way to urge and push North Korea to a more constructive role in the world and a better life for its people, I try not to be surprised too often. But I think it was very disappointing. It's fair to say that in the early months. You know, this is a regime that has been in power now since the division of Korea and the establishment of North Korea and the end of the Korean War, and from grandfather to father to son, it has at every point, I think, taken the wrong choice for its people, for developing the kind of economy and society that, you know, makes sense in the world we live in. You see someone young in their 20s coming in, you hear that he had a little education or a little exposure overseas, yeah, you have to hope, well, maybe that would make things a little bit different. But North Korea's a hard problem that's been with us for quite a while, but we don't give up with it. I think we have to continue to try to work with this, what diplomacy is, and work with this, what life is, work with the circumstances we're presented with. And I think what we've tried to do with the new leader of North Korea is to say in a very consistent way, the door is still open, as it's been for some time, to a different future for North Korea when it makes some choices, moving away from pursuing nuclear weapons and missiles that are very ill-spent, among other things, and focusing more on a more sustainable and stable life for its people and for the region.
How would you rate the danger of that region right now? And by that, I mean we went through this period, I think, in the spring where there was a lot of threats coming out of mm-hmm. North Korea, and I know South Korean government was very concerned about it as well. Mm-hmm. It waxes and wanes. We seem to have these periods where these threats are made and then things settle down again, and it's hard to imagine when the threat truly is serious, I guess.
Well, it's something that we and our South Korean allies and others in the region, Japan and China and other, the other countries of the region, have been dealing with really, in a sense, for 60 years, since it was an armistice, not a permanent peace treaty, but an armistice that ended the conflict of the Korean War. And it is, at best, a very, very imperfect peace. And there have been, as you suggest, times of increased tensions and somewhat decreased tensions. But it's never been a time when we can say, we've got it right now. We haven't. I think the strong security alliance that the United States has with South Korea, South Korea's own success, not only as an economy but as a democracy, China's a growing role in the region and the world, Japan's, all of those, and our ability to work together on these things are all things that have allowed us to continue to have a region that's enjoyed, with the exception of North Korea, an exceptional blossoming. Now, look how life has changed for hundreds of millions of people in China over the last few decades. So there's a great success story in Northeast Asia, and indeed in East Asia as a whole. And I think the U.S., our open markets, our military presence, our alliance relationships have been a part of that success. But North Korea has remained the outlier, and it's something we need to continue to work on. So we can't assume that there's not going to be another uptick in tensions, but I think we look to some of our diplomatic as well as our military tools to try to ensure that that we respond appropriately and clearly along with the United Nations and send a clear message and do what's necessary to really try to maintain stability and peace. It's so important to us as well as, of course, the region itself.
I have one final question for you, and this is a really big picture question, and it's about diplomacy as an art form and as a political reality. There's been a lot of discussion, especially in the recent atrocity in Syria, and how the U.S. should or should not have responded to that. Mm-hmm. And it appears that diplomacy has succeeded for now in avoiding military intervention there. It brought up the whole discussion of how worthwhile diplomacy is as opposed to waving the sword.
I actually like something that Secretary Clinton said while she was in office, and this is kind of her watchword, and she said that American foreign policy needed to be based on a three-legged stool. As we all know, that three legs makes a pretty good basis, and they were what she called the three Ds of defense, diplomacy, and development. And you need to have all of these. You have all these legs of the stool kind of in place to have something viable. Obviously, we're a long way from seeing a satisfactory resolution of the situation in Syria in any way. But I think we have seen over the last few weeks, and I'm not involved in these myself as I've now left my diplomatic career, but we've seen a very interesting discussion that's also involved the American people and many of our allies and other partners around the world who don't always see the same things the same way about how we can use these tools to get to an outcome that, yes, I mean, the goal has to be to avoid further loss of life, to avoid military force, except in the last possible instance, and to use all the tools in your toolkit. So I think that's been a rather illuminating discussion in many ways. We have to kind of wait and see, and not just wait and see, but work hard on diplomacy, is what, and be ready with our our defense elements as we see how the situation unfolds in Syria. You know, my own view is that well, I've heard a lot of this debate that the use of chemical weapons is something that the international community, not just the United States, but the international community needs to take very, very seriously. And I'm glad to see that attention being focused in the United Nations and elsewhere on that. I think that's been very important.
North Korea has a stash itself of chemical weapons.
This is an issue that resonates globally.
I have been speaking with Ambassador Kathleen Stevens. She was the first female ambassador to South Korea from 2008 to 2011 and has had a 35-year career in the Foreign Service and a very successful career in that. It's been a pleasure to talk with you, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.